Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Dr. Paul Farmer is a medical anthropologist, physician, and human rights activist who has dedicated his life to treating the world's poorest populations and raising the standard of healthcare in the most vulnerable regions of the world. Dr. Farmer is one of the founders of Partners in Health, an international nonprofit organization committed to providing a preferential option for the poor. Partners in Health offers direct healthcare services to the sick and those that live in poverty, and even conducts research and advocacy activities to benefit underprivileged populations. Dr. Farmer's work and the Partners in Health organization began in Haiti and has since grown to be a worldwide organization, overseeing hospitals in places such as Rwanda, Malawi, Lesotho, Russia, and Peru. Partners in Health's success has helped to prove that supposedly untreatable health problems can be addressed effectively, even in settings of poverty. Farmer has also worked in infectious disease control in the Americas for many years and is a world-renowned authority on tuberculosis treatment and control. Paul Farmer is an attending physician in infectious diseases and chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and is medical director of the Clinique Bon Secours in rural Haiti. Former United States President Bill Clinton recently appointed Farmer as the United Nations Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti to assist in advancing the economic and social development of the impoverished Caribbean nation. Dr. Farmer's work draws primarily on his active clinical practice, and he focuses on diseases that disproportionately and excessively affect the poor. He is also the author or co-author of over 100 scholarly publications and has published 4 books. His work was documented in the 2004 Tracy Kidder work, Mountains Beyond Mountains, which I had the great privilege of reading and reflecting on this past spring in a leadership course focusing on social change. Dr. Farmer's work is inspiring to me because of his action without question. He recognizes that, above all, we are one human family, a global community, and that with privilege comes responsibility, a responsibility to serve our fellow members of this world, especially those who need it most. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming a truly transformational leader of our world today and an inspiration to us all, Dr. Paul Farmer.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. It's really a privilege to be here. This is only my second time in San Diego, and it's wonderful to be at the university and to have this sponsored by the Joan Kroc Institute, by the nursing school, and by this committee, which is marking its 20th year, means a great deal to me. And I hope to engage in conversation with those here, and I understand there are people in another room as well. And that's why I'm here, is to engage in conversation. It's also, I want to say in starting, though, that I was able to meet some of the students and also a group of women peacemakers who are here in San Diego and have been here for a while. And I hope I get to form those kind of connections to the university. And finally, before launching into an example of our work, which is, again, when I say our work, it's not mine. It is the work of Partners in Health and many, many partners, small p as well. I'd like to say thank you to the Rauner family. I wish that I could have met Dr. Rauner. It's just wonderful to hear students and others here reflect on her example, and I look forward to reading more about what she has done and continues to do through her legacy in promoting critical reflection on health and social justice at this university. So thank you very much to her family who are here today. I was assigned this title. Now, I don't know who chose it. I like it, though. And if it was Mr. Line, I'm very grateful. If it was Diana, thank you. But I came back from Haiti about, I think, 1 in the morning on Saturday morning. And they said, here, you're going to do this. And I said, good, I like this topic. And I want to say in discussing rights issues, say at the outset that rights, the notion of rights is a very critical paradigm, I think, for the 21st century, as it has been for many, many centuries. But it's really, it has new meaning now, in my view. And this is not an original view. Others have written about it. And one of the reasons it has new meaning in medicine and public health is that we have more effective deliverables. And I'm going to give an example of what I mean by that. We have more effective deliverables than we did in the mid-20th century or in the late, when, for example, the notion of health as a human right became enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I'd like to draw that out and using some examples from our work and then open this up to a discussion. There are other paradigms as well which are complementary. I would parse at least three. I will parse at least three in this talk. In addition to the rights framework, the one that many of us are familiar with, and I think this is true in nursing as well, is the public health paradigm. And it's also very useful. And then finally, or not finally, but another very critical and complementary paradigm is the development paradigm. Now, you can meld these things together, right? You can say that in order to see genuine development, there have to be investments, significant investments in public health and public education. And you won't see genuine development, you won't break that cycle of poverty and disease unless you make substantial investments in public health and education. I would feel comfortable using any one of those three paradigms, economic development, public health paradigms, or rights paradigms. And what I'll try to do tonight, and I won't be long, my formal remarks will only take about 2.5 hours. So, and then you can be relaxed because you know I just flew from Boston, so I'll never last that long. But I will, it's 10:30 my time. It's 10:30 in Haiti. But then I will open this up, you know, after using a half an hour of your time with specific examples. I'd like to, the last time I was here was at the Salk Institute some years ago, and some of you were good enough to be at this talk. This will be what I've been thinking about, including in the last few months, in contemplating some of the challenges that I've seen working in Haiti. This is the 27th year I've been working there. Haiti's my greatest teacher. Actually, there's some friends here from Haiti are here tonight. But I want to start with the specifics. Now, let me just... This came to me after seeing the title that was given to me. I was going to say foisted upon me, but given to me. You know, when you listen to patients, and this is something we are supposed to learn in medicine and nursing, is you know, you have to stop and listen to patients. I was being interviewed by a freshman who's and also a junior who's writing for the newspaper. And I was talking about the importance of listening, and it sounded kind of snooty to say audition, you know, to listen. And what I found out in the early 80s when I first went to Haiti that what you read or what leaders say might or might not reflect what people living in poverty might say. Now, I mentioned poverty not because it's the defining characteristic of Haiti. It's not. I'll give other examples of how Haiti has defined itself through the struggle for dignity and freedom and really introducing modernity to this hemisphere. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But it is nonetheless true that whether I'm in Haiti or Boston or Peru or Rwanda, the great majority of the patients who I see are poor. So poverty is a defining issue for them. One of the things that the student I met with earlier asked me, she asked me if it was a cultural problem. It's a great question, a cultural problem, a challenge to advance a rights model in some of these places. And I said, not really a cultural problem. And here's an example that I would offer. This is a quotation from a rights declaration. And I've heard this sort of thing over 20 years. And these are claims made about rights, including what I'm calling social and economic rights, the right to health care, the right to education, by people who have not enjoyed them. And so there's a conundrum for us to contemplate and to think about collectively. whether or not people enjoy access to the right to health care or education does not seem to determine whether or not they're able to comment eloquently on the need for these basic rights. And I think that's something to really keep in mind, something I learned in Haiti and later explored in talking about Catholic social teachings. That's what you'll hear in liberation theology as well. And it's what we're supposed to do in nursing and clinical services writ large. So this is been the dominant chord struck all these years of working in Haiti and elsewhere, is that people will talk about their rights, whether they've had them or not. Then you see the alternatives that are offered by others not living in poverty. And here's where, you know, going between Harvard and Haiti was a very instructive experience and remains so for me. We may or may not be lucky enough to hear people in places like Harvard or San Diego talk about the need for rights. Here at the nursing school today, for example, there was a talk or a conference on healthcare as a right. But we may or may not be lucky enough. You were lucky enough to have this, pointing to the dean and the provost. Met the president also earlier today. And that, I think, is a good thing. But reliably, in my experience, people living in poverty will demand their rights. Whether or not we listen to them is the big challenge. Now, the development paradigm, and this is, I just mentioned, those last several years, and I've been working in Haiti, I said, since 1983, and I've seen a lot of ups and downs. And I've also seen, in talking about the ups, I've seen the Haitian people rally around basic democratic goals, which include the right to health care and education. Some people would call that a social justice platform, a social and economic rights platform. It's been the most moving and instructive thing I've seen in my 50 years on the planet. But there are, nonetheless, enormous problems. And this is from the Director General of the Pan American Health Organization. I should have spelled that out. Who was herself in Haiti during this year. She's been a frequent visitor to Haiti, and I know her quite well. And she cares a lot about the Haitian people. And for her to say, and others like me to say, we're not going to break this cycle of poverty and disease without significant investments in health care and education, I think we stand by this. That said, how do we link our work as public health practitioners, again, whether doctors or nurses or community health workers, how do we link that to the broader social justice goals that the Haitian people clearly have espoused? And this is not different in El Salvador or Chiapas, Mexico, or elsewhere in this hemisphere where I've been, nor is it different in Africa. This is a very common struggle. How can we use investments in healthcare and education as a lever to advance these broader development goals? I want to give some examples. This is just from this past weekend. These pictures were taken Friday morning. And the reason I show the picture of the Citadel is, and this is President Clinton, as I referred to him on Saturday when I got back, I said I don't want to drop names, but I was with a former president of the United States who is like the Energizer Bunny, and I'd said he was from Arkansas, and then I got a little bit of a laugh. But this is Patrick de la Tour, whose title now in Haiti is the Minister of Tourism. He's also a scholar of the Citadel. And the Citadel, as many of you know, is the Haitian symbol of resistance to slavery. And I was contemplating giving a little talk on Haitian history. I won't do that, you'll be glad to know. But when we talk about development and Haiti, it was mentioned already, Haiti is, you know, an impoverished place. It's really important to note that Haiti was also the birthplace of the modern rights movement in this hemisphere in many ways. So in 1789, for example, when the French, some people in France, obviously not everybody, advanced the, I believe it's called the Declaration of the Rights of Man, if I'm not mistaken, or the citizen, that's what it was, the citoyen, and then came the rights of man. So we have to think very critically about gender equity as well. But when they did that in 1789, of course, they had a slave colony or two or three, and the largest one was Haiti. And so it was the Haitian people who pushed forward that question, what does that mean, rights, liberty, equality, fraternity? What does that mean? Does it really mean liberty, equality, fraternity for everyone? So I think that the starting point for me in talking about Haiti and poverty and development is always to think back with a great deal of respect at what was accomplished by the Haitian people. And 3 weeks ago, when I was, I had been to the Citadel several times when I was, you know, younger in the 80s and brought members of my family there, and it was just a very staggering monument. I'm just curious, how many people have seen the Citadel? Raise your hands. How many people have ever seen a picture of the Citadel? Not too many. I mean, but this is one of the, this is a marvel of modernity. This was started in the early 19th century. And the story is critical to reflection on development and social justice in Haiti. When the slaves began their revolt in 1791, this led to the Haitian Revolution, which in 1803, November of 1803, led to the victory of the slaves against Napoleon's armies. It is estimated by some historians that up to 80,000 people sailed, 40,000 ground troops and 40,000 Marines, conscripted from all over Europe, by the way, by Napoleon, mostly French, but from all over. When they set sail for Haiti, this was the largest armada ever to go back in this in direction from Europe to the New World, and they were going back to reconquer Haiti for the French. And when the Haitians, the former slaves, won this victory against the Europeans, they built in the northern. Of course, you know, many of them went into the hills because they didn't want any corporal forms of labor. That is, labor that was conscripted in any way, as it had been in the slave plantations. But in the north, a series of fortifications all over the island were built. And they were really, instead of projecting Haitian power into the sea around, and they were surrounded by hostile countries, the only other country in the New World was the United States, 1776. They instead pulled their fortifications inward, and this is one of them. Now, the reason I'm going into such detail is because very few people have visited this monument, and very few people from outside. Even the Haitian school children have not been there, and that's something I was led to think about by Patrick de la Tour, whose picture is here. When he talks about his country, he doesn't talk about Haiti being impoverished or beleaguered. He says sometimes, I'm sure, but he talks about the Haitian people's success and victory, going from 500,000 slaves who became victors in this revolution to 10 million people. You know, some people in Haiti also think about the successes of their movement. And that's something I like to start any reflection about Haiti with that point, that in many ways Haitians moved us forward as a world. And I think we have a debt to the Haitian people, and I'd like to acknowledge that at the outset. Now, I'm not a historian, nor am I a development expert. I'm instead a physician. I just want to talk a little bit about my own experience. And some of you have heard this before, but since this is only my second visit to San Diego, I'm going to assume that most of you have not. When I graduated from college, I was lucky enough to go to Haiti between college and medical school, and I ended up in this place. Now, it looks kind of idyllic here, and I've described this in my own writings, and I know all of you have read my books because I can tell by the fantastic sales. By the way, you introduced me as having written 4 books, but clearly you miss my landmark bestseller, The Global Threat of Drug-Resistant Tuberculosis. In any case, I should be careful because my publisher is actually the University of California. They're great publishers, and I'm still work with them. They've been terrific. They have. And now this is on University of California television or something, and they're going to think I'm maligning my favorite press in the world. They're terrific. But this place, it looks idyllic, but it's actually a hydroelectric dam. And this is the way I got introduced to development questions. You know, 23 years old, listening to people, learning how to speak the local language, Haitian Creole, and listening to people complain about a development project. Because I was living behind the dam, and the people who I was living with had lost their land to this hydroelectric dam. And the first time I heard these stories about people being driven up into the hills by the rising waters, I thought they were being a little bit poetic. But many of them really did leave their lands, their ancestors' gardens, as they put it, the day the water rose. And I heard the story again and again, and I realized that they were not exaggerating. This was really how they experienced that development project. Now, all I'm saying is I had actually Tracy Kidder, and he wrote a book that actually many people have read about our work in Haiti. And he asked me one day, this is true, he said, "Do you have something against dams?" I had no idea what he was talking about because it seemed out of context. He was talking about my echoing the complaints that I'd heard about this development project. And I said, "Of course I don't. You know, why are you asking the question?" And I learned a lot about how poor people experience development by starting in this squatter settlement. And again, I think that's been helpful to me in other places where we have worked, certainly for me personally, but also with my colleagues at Partners in Health. But again, I'm not a development expert, nor am I a historian. This is the picture of the dam. Instead, I chose a different path in life, which was to be a physician. Now, I am not an infectious disease physician because of AIDS. Rather, I went to Haiti, as I said, and before HIV came along, and I saw a number of people who I worked with who were also displaced, whose families had lost their land to this hydroelectric dam. I worked with young people more or less my age, and we went around from village to village doing a basic primary health care survey. This was beginning in 83-84. And then I began doing this shuttling back and forth from between Harvard and Haiti, which I'm still doing today. And there were about six young Haitians working with I was working with them. Three of them died of infectious diseases, one of malaria, one of typhoid fever, and one of what's called puerperal sepsis. She basically died shortly after childbirth. And I don't really talk about this very much publicly, but I can tell you that it was really a terrible experience just as a friend and coworker. And sometimes, I thought, how does one ever, and think about the families of these young people, how does one ever recover from these kind of tragedies? And, of course, I'm not the person who got malaria. I did get malaria, but I'm not the person who got really sick with malaria or typhoid or... and certainly, I'm not able to experience complications of childbirth. But it was what set me on this path in infectious disease. And so when a new pathogen came along, HIV, this is from something called worldmapper.org, and I've used these images quite a bit in my teaching, and I think you'll find them useful. I didn't steal them, by the way, although Catholic social justice teachings would probably have me exonerated if I did steal something from the internet. Don't tweet that, by the way. Anybody can find this, but this is what's. I'm not sure what year the data are from, but I'm sure you can see what this is. It's a map in which the dimensions of these countries are based on the burden of disease, and you could do the same thing with diabetes or tuberculosis. But what struck me and this is why I'm going to get back to this model that was born out of this survey. That I mentioned that was being conducted by a series of young people, was we knew that there were not a lot of physicians and nurses. And again, I should have used nurses. So, if you look at this image, you see Haiti is bigger than the Dominican Republic, you see how large Africa is, but this is physicians working. Now, the reason that we developed the model that I'm going to describe in passing, which is a health worker model, was not because we didn't have physicians. It was because the highest standard of care for a chronic disease is what Catholic social teaching would call accompaniment. And what does accompaniment look like? You can imagine what it might mean to you. Say if you had a chronic disease or even an acute illness or you didn't have housing, say, or a job. What would accompaniment look like for you? And for me, it was listening to people living in poverty in rural Haiti describe what they would regard as accompaniment. How would we walk with them? And one of the things that they needed, of course, was medicines. I mentioned a Harvard Haiti trajectory, but I would just say I started medical school in the fall of 1984, and by the early 90s, when HIV was becoming a problem in Haiti and elsewhere in the world, I was training in clinical medicine. So I was going from one of the best hospitals I've ever seen, the Brigham and Women's Hospital where I trained, to a place where we were struggling to build healthcare infrastructure. And in and of itself, I think some of the students will be interested in this, the extremity of this disparity was in itself instructive. You don't want to wish that kind of learning on just anybody. There are ways to learn about poverty that do not require for you to go and be a spectator to poverty. But it's also instructive just to experience that trajectory. And again, I had these great teachers, both at Harvard and in Haiti. And so in 2002, and I don't want to dwell on this, but in 2002, when many years after effective therapy, suppressive therapy would be called, for AIDS was developed, it was still being argued that it was not cost-effective to deliver this care in a place like rural Haiti or rural Africa. And, you know, the reason I say I'm not going to dwell on this, this is from 2002, but it was the very years that we were trying to organize a coherent response at the policy level to the fact that AIDS had become the leading infectious killer of young adults in the world, and we didn't have a strategy. Among the people who are here with me tonight is Cassia Holstein, who is one of the founders of an effort which I will describe, which was to organize efforts to introduce treatment into broader treatment and prevention schemes. Let me just want to pay a tribute to her. This was before people like Cassia and the Clinton Foundation got involved, 2002. The average wholesale price for doesn't matter what the regimen is. For those of you who are physicians or specialists, will just be interested. These are the drugs we had back then. We're still drugs that we use to treat complications of HIV disease. A three-drug regimen cost about $10,000 per patient per year. You know, but as one might argue, and as I have said to my students, is that the beginning of the conversation about drug pricing or the end of it? Even in that year, it was possible to find, this PIH means Partners in Health, we were able to find three-drug regimens for $700 a year, which is still way out of range. But it just shows the same year there were other strategies. IDA means the International Dispensary Association, which is the world's largest nonprofit distributor of drugs, procurement agency, basically. So the point here is not about the specific regimens or the specific prices, because I'm going to talk about cancer. I was on the phone today talking about insulin. But basically the general question about rights and development is, how do we respond to this kind of really therapeutic chaos, just in terms of the prices, but how do we respond with a rights-based approach so that we can advance the cause of health and social justice and have that be the beginning of a conversation? Now, that's not how we got involved. We got involved, and last time I was in San Diego at the Salk Institute, I showed this before and after picture of the young man up in the corner. So I wanted to use another one. This is the kind of dramatic response that we've seen again and again to introducing the standard of care in responding to AIDS. And I'll show you, for other pathologies, it's the same story. This is a patient who I knew well since she was a young woman and went off to the city, came back sick. That's her dying of AIDS in 1999, and then a few years later. And here are these two patients actually giving a talk at Harvard last year. And you could actually go onto the PIH website and listen to what they had to say. I was their translator. My friends who are here with me are going to, if I tell the same story more than two or three times, they start lifting up. It's a very rude thing to do, I might add. But since this just happened last year, I'm guessing I haven't told this too often, but I was translating for them. You can watch this. That's the miracle of the internet, although the tweeting word wasn't created back then a year ago. It probably was, but I had never heard it. This guy who's been on therapy for a long time, I mentioned first-line ART, and if you're interested in what that means, it means first-line antiretroviral therapy. The reason they're still getting the same regimen is they have community health workers. More on that in a bit. There were about 1,000 people there at this conference, including maybe 50 or 60 Haitians at least, who understood Creole. And I was sitting next to him, and he said, "Before I start, I'd really like to thank all you bourgeois people in the audience for helping us." That was his first line. Now, I knew what he meant. I knew he just meant people, because that's the Haitian word for people who are not poor. And it probably comes from, looking at my Haitian friends, they know it's still the, you know, it's still the usage in Haiti too. It means people aren't poor. But translating that was a bit of a struggle because everybody who could speak Haitian started cracking up before I could say a word. Anyway, there they were. You could listen to them both. They gave these beautiful testimonies about their own experience. And listening to people with very difficult to manage problems is part of having a rights-based approach to development. That's my thesis tonight. And I'm just using this one example because it's well documented. This is a child, though, with a malignancy. And how many times have you heard people say, well, we can't treat cancer? I mean, you probably haven't heard this, but how many times have I heard it, I guess is the point. We can't treat cancer in Africa. Or we can't, you know, we have to only focus on prevention, as if these were choices you make between prevention and care. So the same story that I described around AIDS or diabetes or major mental health problems, I didn't describe, but I could describe, is it's always the same story. Is that an equity focus, again, back to the hypotheses, whether you're focusing on the development paradigm, on the rights paradigm, or the public health paradigm, equity and social justice are always important and instructive. This is the same child, of course, before and after therapy. Now, can you scale up models like this? This is another challenge, of course. I'm not saying this is not a challenge. Each place there's a red dot here. These are places where partners in health working with partners, of course. That's the whole point of calling it partners in health. But our primary partner has been the Ministry of Health, the public health sector in Haiti. All of these places are places where we're trying to scale this up, to find new partners, to scale. And the this in question is a comprehensive approach to basic health. And we'd like to link that, of course, to education and jobs outside of the health sector. And I'm going to return to that question in closing. And there are other challenges. What about, I mentioned Africa because in showing you the map, if I were to take malaria, to take that worldmapper.org site and look at the malaria map or tuberculosis or, again, the number of nurses working, it would be a very similar set of dimensions. And this is something that was really posed to us most forcefully by President Clinton and the Clinton Foundation in 2003, actually in Haiti, saying, you know, you ought to take this rural model that's focused on rebuilding public infrastructure and on community health workers and bring it to Africa. And, you know, we finally did. One of my first trips to Africa, not to Africa, but to Rwanda, and this is the logo of the Rwandan Ministry of Health. We were invited by President Clinton and the Rwandan Ministry of Health to come and work there. It was a great privilege. This is in the fall of 2004. And the first place we went was to a town in northern Rwanda called Ruwengeri. I'm just curious, how many people here have been to Rwanda? It's an amazing, amazing place and a very inspiring place to think of where they were in 1994 and where they are now in 2009. And where they were already in 2004, the time of this trip. But at that time, they did not have a lot of healthcare infrastructure. There were, in fact, out of 28 districts, four of them had no district hospitals at all. The first place we went did have a district hospital, and it was in the north, and it was a beautiful place. It had electricity. There were three or four doctors there and x-ray machines, and it was clean. And so I said, you know, you can send us somewhere more difficult. Somebody laughed a little bit, and you're right to laugh, because they took us very seriously, and they said, okay, why don't you go here? Now, this place is called Ringwava, which I always wanted it to mean something very dramatic. But it really means land of the rabbits, which did not strike me as dramatic. There are a lot of rabbits there, but, you know, you wanted leopards. I finally saw a leopard. But we went to the land of the rabbits, and there was an abandoned hospital. And actually, because we had had this experience in Haiti building up public infrastructure and working with our Haitian colleagues also went with us. We had the Rwandan Ministry of Health, the Clinton Foundation, Partners in Health, which was soon to found a new local organization, and our colleagues from Haiti. And we also knew how to build partnerships with the local communities. which is a challenge. And so we were not phased. We knew, kind of knew what to do. We had to build infrastructure. We had to provide services. We had to train local people to do this work. And as Kelsey was good enough to say, and I believe her exact words, we even did some research and advocacy work. Where did Kelsey go? Where are you? You're right to say it that way. Because often what happens is people who are involved in the service delivery don't do the research. So there's not a natural feedback loop to improve the quality. And it's easier in some ways to skip over that, but it's a really important thing to do. So that we knew how to do that. And so this image that many of you have seen in elsewhere in Africa of a disheveled, abandoned hospital ward, it's the same. This is the same ward just a few months later. And again, it's not, we have to say this with some humility, it's not that difficult a thing to do. It, you know, implementation is always difficult, but the ideas themselves are pretty straightforward. I met some people here tonight who are supporting blood banking in Africa, and I applauded that because, again, there's the infrastructure investments are critical. You can't do good medical care without the tools of the trade, and that includes operating rooms. And so going in to do that was not easy, but at least we knew how to do it, and we had good partners. This is a laboratory before and after. And I just wanted to pay tribute, as I said, to some of my Haitian colleagues. This is a doctor and a nurse who were, this is 2005, who were went from Haiti to Rwanda to help implement this comprehensive model. And they're still working on these kind of projects to this day. This is the model. It's not rocket science. I guess here in San Diego, I actually have some friends here who are in the Navy, so it's not like nuclear submarines, okay? It's not that tricky. Or nuclear submarines, as a former president of ours said. And the results are the same. You know, the same sort of transformations that you see in Haiti, you're going to see anywhere else. And there's not a different pathophysiology to these diseases. This is a guy who had both AIDS and tuberculosis. And again, I know that my colleagues are going to lift their hands and go like this because I've already said this joke. He goes from looking like Skeletor to looking like he needs Lipitor. Anyway, and so President Clinton, this is the same village. This is, you know, I want to, again, I want to say that I've learned a lot just in terms of health care in working with the Clinton Foundation. This is 2006, so now the hospital's all spruced up. And he was again there again last August, but this kind of partnership with the public sector, with community organizations, with NGOs, like because Clinton Foundation is an NGO as its partners, there's a lot of promise in these public and private partnerships. Now there's a lot of peril as well, as has been remarked by a number of people. Anytime you hear a call for a public-private partnership, you know that things aren't working. I regarded that as humor as well. It's come on, I've flown all the way to San Diego. At least you can laugh at my nerdy quasi-academic public health jokes. And we're developing a series we have developed at Harvard. And Jim Kim, who's now the president of Dartmouth University, and some of my colleagues at Harvard and in the field, in these sites, we're trying to develop a series of case studies to look at what's specific, you know, what's got cultural specificity or historical specificity, but what also are the generalizable lessons learned. And I think this is one of them, that if you build efforts to strengthen the public infrastructure in healthcare and education, you raise the possibility of actually respecting poor people's rights or people's rights in general. As I was saying to the student who was interviewing me earlier, if you, you know, and there were five of us in the room. The two UCD, USD, sorry. two USD students. Two of my friends from Partners in Health, me. Does that equal five? And we went around the room and said, where'd you go to high school? Where'd you go to high school? Everybody, all of us went to public high schools. Actually, you were the fifth person, sorry. We all went to public high schools. But when you're in a public high school, you don't stop and think, gee, I'm really glad the public sector in this country is strong enough so that I get to go to high school. Actually, that may not be true in California. I'm sorry. That was really sorry. I want California to succeed. Otherwise, my publisher will be out of work. But the basic model is true even in California. That you need public infrastructure, and that may look like public schools. It may look like public health clinics. And I don't think a lot of us, at least I didn't grow up in the United States, I didn't stop to think how important this was to the rights struggle. But it is critically important. And this is why we keep getting back to learning how to do this in the public sector. It's in some ways easier to do it, to do development, health and development work as an NGO or a church group or missionary groups. I mean, I know many of you are involved in those kind of activities and will remain, as I am, involved in these kind of activities. I guess the challenge that we're contemplating is how can we add up to more than the sum of our parts? Because clearly there's a great deal of passion and interest in health and social justice, certainly in American universities. But how can we make this more effective? And that's what I'd like to think about for the rest of my life. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk about one pathologist. This is, again, back to Rwanda. This is a child who I was actually there the night she came in. Her name is Tushime. And I can just tell you, her father had schlepped all over Rwanda. That's not a local Rwandan word. But he traveled all over Rwanda. And, you know, with his daughter who, you know, she was, I think, 12, maybe a little bit older. And I remember the night she came in, you know, and people were giving her a wide berth because this was infected, and we'll go into details, but it smelled very unpleasant. And I'll tell you what I thought, and this is kind of pitiful. I thought, you know, I hope that's an infection only and not cancer. And I'll just leave you, this is too big a crowd to have Socratic exchange, but I'll leave you to wonder why I thought that. And it's obvious. I thought that because starting the new struggle again, you know, is it cost effective to treat cancer in Africa? Now, it was cancer. And just as the treatment for AIDS is the same in San Diego or Haiti, antiretroviral therapy, or the treatment for malnutrition is, you know, someone was saying to me the other day, you know, we hope you'll win a Nobel Prize. And I said, yes, I'm sure I'm slated to win one. And my great discovery is the treatment for malnutrition is called food. So the treatment for cancer is chemotherapy. And it's not going to matter whether you're in San Diego or Tijuana or rural Rwanda. So finding a strategy, a way to deliver both preventives, like some of you know about HPV vaccine. HPV vaccine can prevent probably 70-80% of cases of cervical cancer, the vaccines that we have now. So yes, we want to prevent rather than treat. Nobody disagrees with that in clinical medicine either. Same for diabetes, same for major mental health issues. But we do need a strategy that integrates prevention and care. And again, how central this is to development is, you know, remains to be seen. I believe it's very central, but again, we don't want to conflate our own disciplinary training with the nature of the problem. I'm quite convinced that major investments in health and education are necessary. Now, let me just show you a slide that we just cooked up today with my coworkers. Actually, you know, I remind the last time I was here, and the only other time I was in San Diego, I met a scientist at the Salk Institute who had worked on a chemotherapeutic agent, which is marketed as Gleevec. And I said to him, I said, thank you for working on that science, because this is a great treatment the specifics of the indication are not important. But that's what I said as a doctor, you know, thank you, because we need these deliverables. But let me just show you that the same story around AIDS holds true for cancer treatment. This is a very necessary drug. Taxol is the way it's usually termed. But just look at how the prices are all over the map. Same story. And I could take, you know, a treatment for major depressive disorder or, you know, the list goes on and on, right? Or serious complications of coronary artery disease or hypertension. We need an equity strategy to deliver proper therapy for these pathologies. And I think, and many others will agree, that it needs to be front and center in development work, especially when, you know, cancer is going to overtake some of these infectious pathogens as a leading killer in Africa. Now, how is that related to development? And then I want to close in just raising this as a question and open it for discussion. If you're a physician, and again, I'm speaking as a clinician, so physician or nurse sitting in a clinic, and you have patients with chronic wasting diseases, you know, in my experience, they'll come in and they'll start talking about their symptoms, right? If they're sick, if they're really symptomatic, they'll start talking about their symptoms. So they may say, you know, I can't breathe, or can't stand up, or I have chronic diarrhea, whatever it may be. But once you get them on therapy, what do they start talking about? They start talking about their children, their housing situation. Did they want, you know, one student in an interview, which is a very moving interview, one patient of mine from Haiti in an interview, which, you know, came back from the brink of death, and I didn't do the interview. It was a Haitian guy, a friend of mine, a colleague, who did the interview. But whenever someone asks to have something translated from Haitian Creole into English, guess who gets the job? It wasn't that long ago, so I'm sitting there listening to the earphones, with earphones. I don't have an iPod, by the way, if anyone wants to give me one. I was listening to this, and I was transcribing on my computer. And I was all alone, and I was kind of glad I was alone, because I got very emotional when I heard this guy say, the interviewer says, well, you've just had this incredible near-death experience. What would you like to do with your life? And he said, I think it's idiotic that someone who's 27 years old does not know how to read and write. I want to learn how to read and write. And, you know, it's just a reminder that people all over the world have similar aspirations. They want their kids to be in school. They want to have jobs. And the jobs issue has been very critical for Partners in Health and for all of us who've worked in this arena. Partners in Health now has 11,000 people worldwide working for Partners in Health. The great majority of those people have never held a job before. It's their first job. Most of them are community health workers. Now, I'm very proud of that. And I think my coworker is very proud of that. To give families a chance to have a job is what people want. That's the development that they mean. Of course, the job conditions have to be good, right? And I'm not sure we're doing a good job yet with community health workers. We still have a long way to go. They want things like accreditation. I can't tell you how many times I've been in some rinky-dink little village. That's a scholarly sociological term, rinky-dink. I'm going to put it in my next index. Rinky-dink, comma, C small. University of California. Actually, they vet the index, and they've taken out little smart aleck entries that I put into the indices. So those of you who are paying taxes in California, rest assured that your editorial leaders are really careful. So, wait, you don't pay taxes in California. Anyway, so I've been to these little villages, and I've seen community health workers who say, what we really want is a certificate. I said, what do you mean? A diploma, accreditation. And, you know, if you don't listen to those kind of things, you miss an important part of the whole dignity discussion. And they talk about jobs. These are just some images from our work. You know, when patients get better, say the people you saw who have wasting diseases, who are like with AIDS, and they start getting better, that's the first thing they want to do. We need jobs outside of the health and education sector. That's what we really need now. We need generative jobs that are going to be, as they say, sustainable. Now, so for someone who has been critiquing this notion of sustainable development as used uncritically, you might wonder, why am I going on about jobs? And the answer is, we were never under the illusion that people did not need jobs. In the mid-80s, I began interviewing women with AIDS, and I wrote another bestseller with my colleagues in 1995 called Women, Poverty, and AIDS. I know you all read it. Actually, there's a very suspicious locus of sales activities in Orlando, Florida, where my mother lives. And that's the only... So, Women, Poverty, and AIDS. And I remember interviewing people for this book, and many people worked on the book, but this woman said, look, you want to stop AIDS in Haiti? Give women jobs. And it was true in the 80s, it's true now. Now, how to do that is something I hope that we'll be able to discuss tonight. This is just a workshop in the land of the rabbits, Ringuavu. And it was an abandoned workshop that we were granted permission to take over. This had been a mining village. And these lathes and other equipment, it was abandoned. And some young Rwandans rehabilitated this and then created a workshop where a number of people could work. And now what they're doing right here is making furniture, but we're really kind of making furniture to sell to ourselves, to the hospitals and clinics. What we need is a market. And that's not something I learned how to do in Harvard Medical School. You know, it's not like fourth-year rotation in marketing furniture. But that doesn't mean we don't need how to do it. It doesn't mean I need to learn how to do it. It means that it must be done. And that's something that comes out of partnerships, is that you listen to what people are saying about development, and they'll guide you. Now, this, just back to Haiti, and this is a famous kind of image. I'm just curious, how many people know what this is? Some of you. That's right. It's one half Haiti, the other half Dominican Republic. And that's the border. Last fall, I was in Haiti when these hurricanes struck. And it was a very jarring experience. So four storms hit Haiti in the space of a month. And the city of Gonaïve was underwater. It was a terrible thing to see. And I'd only seen it once before, for a city to be underwater and people streaming out as refugees days after. And that was in the same city in 2004. When probably 3,000 people were killed by Tropical Storm Jean, not even a hurricane, hit Cuba too, and there was no loss of life. But when it hit Haiti, the trees were gone, there were flash floods, and people in this flood-pained city were swept to sea. It was a terrible thing. And then for that to happen again last year, 13, 14 months ago, was pretty jarring. For the people of Gonaïve, of course, but just to see it. And I wrote a piece that we ended up, we put it on the Partners in Health website. I'm sure it's still there because, unfortunately, things that go onto the internet stay there forever somehow. But I sent it to every political figure I knew, which isn't that many, but quite a few. And one of them actually got back to me the next day, and that was President Clinton. And he started talking about building back better. I understood the rhetorical nature of building back better, that he said, you know, we can seize this opportunity to help Haiti. And I saw him in Rwanda a couple months before in August when he came to visit the work we've been doing there. And he said that this is what we should do, is think about how to rebuild Haitian public institutions and infrastructure, and also reforest Haiti and think about job creation. And so one of the things I've been saying, well, how do you do that? And then these pictures are both from, I think, Thursday and Friday. And I'm advancing this very humbly because I'd like other people's opinions. We would too. How do you create jobs, and how do you create the kind of dignity and social security that people in Haiti are asking for, and elsewhere in the world? And this is image on the bottom is from a recycling project that uses garbage, and what's in the garbage matters, but to make briquettes that could be alternatives to charcoal. This is not just a problem for Haiti. It's a problem all over the world where trees are cut down to make charcoal. And Haiti, it's a crisis, but it's a problem elsewhere. And fish farms, my friend from the Clinton Foundation, who's sitting right there, said, not tilapia again. Thank you for your support, Cassia. But really, you know, the figure that I heard on this is Thursday afternoon, was from this brilliant young, not that young, but this brilliant agronomist who was actually from the Ivory Coast, from Côte d'Ivoire. I was working with Haitians for many years. He went to Auburn as a PhD. And he said he had all of the facts. Right at every question he was asked, he had all the answers. It was really very moving. He said the average intake of fish in Haiti is 7 pounds per person per year. In Jamaica, it's 70. And what I was thinking, of course, is, wait, I have all these patients who come in who are malnourished, children who have protein, calorie, malnutrition. What can we do to link these development efforts to the kind of public health problems that we see? And that is where 27 years after going there, that's where I am. That's where I am now. That's what I'm interested in. Many of my coworkers are interested. But again, back to what we heard in the early 80s when we first went to an area disrupted by a development project, a hydroelectric dam, the same story. People want jobs. They want to control their own fates. They want assistance, yes, but they also want dignity. And I think that is something that we can draw on, this kind of social teaching and work that you've discussed, kind of work that's been discussed here this past week by those, including the women peacemakers are here. This is bringing this all together in a seamless approach to health and social justice and development, I think, is where we're headed today. So thank you, and I'll open it up for discussion now.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.